Welcome, everyone, to episode number 91 of Underserved. With me today is Sesh Tiramala, CIO at PagerDuty. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Sesh, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thank you, Andrew. So happy to be here.
So growing up, going to National Institute of Technology, you weren't really into computers, more into electronics engineering, right?
That's right, Andrew. When I joined school back in the day, honestly, didn't get a chance to look at computers. So I started off in electrical and electronics engineering. That's where I did my bachelor's in engineering. It's a four-year degree. It's in a lovely coastal city called Mangalore. Just like Bangalore, it's a twin city. So I really got into electrical engineering there.
And then after you graduate, what do you end up doing?
Right after college, I joined a company, a Swedish multinational company called ABB, which is Asia Brown Bowery. So they are pioneers in electrical engineering, building transformers and microprocessor-based technology to really help a lot of the electrical grid that we all use power in our daily lives. So when you think of power and distribution over long distances, you know, how do you really protect them from the weather, the climate, or intentional, unintentional outages, and to restore the service as quickly as possible? So again, the company was all about always on electrical grid and power transmission, and how do you build the best technology to continue to serve all the community, the businesses, etc.
Now, after working there for a few years, you hit the road with Oman National Electric?
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's one of those things where you're young, you're early in your career. You know, I spent about 4 years, and then you're having the itch to try something different. And this company in the Middle East, Oman, they reached out for an electrical engineer position, right? And I'm like, hey, it's the Middle East. Let's give it a shot. Different culture, different country, also oil rich. So they pay you well. So again, you're early in career, you want money. So I made that transition into this country. And, you know, there were some things I loved about it and there were some things I did not, but overall it was a great experience.
So you move on from there. Is that when you come to the States?
Yeah, that's right. So right after I come back to India, after my stint at Oman, you know, got married and had no job, right? So the status was you're married, you don't have a job, and then you're exploring your next gig now that you've done electrical engineering and worked for large companies. And in both of these companies, my introduction to computers was I implemented the CAD, computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacturing systems from Autodesk, you know, and this was really useful to build, you know, electrical circuit diagrams, which in the old days was being done by hand. So again, now for the first time, you know, you're using CAD software to generate 3D models, electrical circuit diagrams, blueprints. So that was really fascinating to say, okay, you know, there's the manufacturing expertise, there's the software. So can I make a career transition into software? And there was an opportunity that came by through Oracle Consulting in Ohio, West Virginia town, right? So I'm like, hey, I grabbed the opportunity and then packed my bags and lo and behold, you know, reached the US in two suitcases.
I mean, West Virginia and Ohio, it gets pretty rural out there. What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, it was a big culture shock, right? Because you come in, India is so populated, you have people all over, it's buzzing, etc. And then you come to this little rural town where you barely see anyone. You see more cattle and green fields and corn fields than people, right? So it was a big change. But then slowly, you know, as you get acclimatized at the work environment, you work with your peers, everyone's eager and curious to know your background and how you got there. And again, soon, you know, I made some great friends. You know, they would invite me over for barbecues on Saturdays. And, you know, for being an Indian and not eating red meat, you know, they would accommodate and make vegetarian options as well.
That was nice.
Yeah, that was super nice. Real.
Anyone else from there that you'd like to give a shout out to, or anyone noteworthy you worked with?
Yeah, so my first boss through Oracle Consulting, I worked with EDS Consulting, and Wendell Coleman, you know, was my manager. He was a great guy. He was from California, Pasadena, making his Monday through Thursday trips to West Virginia as well. And then there was another guy called Eddie Roskidal from Texas. So these two guys were very instrumental in helping me settle down. We got to be great friends. We're in touch even now after that many years.
When you moved to Minneapolis, what were you working on?
Yeah, so I think through Oracle Consulting, I'm like, hey, you know, my next assignment, I needed a bigger city. So I got into Minneapolis, but for the weather. So, you know, it had some fantastic malls, the great malls in Minneapolis, right? So I transitioned from, again, it was into a process manufacturing set of clients. So I worked at Valspar, you know, Land O'Lakes, and then Carlson Group of companies in a very short, and Rosemont, Fisher Rosemont as well. So again, came in via Oracle Consulting, did a lot of short 3 to 4 month stints to drive transformation, implement their software, drive some integrations, drive automation, et cetera. And one of the accounts, when I reached there, they were not able to generate invoices for about 4 weeks, and they were really in a bad shape. So again, had to come in, roll up my sleeves, get to the root of the issue, and got the business back up and running with the right root cause analysis and fixes. So again, it was a great experience in Minneapolis, you know, serving 4 different clients, again, meeting different people, cultural differences, but a bigger city, you know, and really made some good lifelong friendships as well.
You mentioned on the pre-call that whenever you're a consultant, you got to hit the ground running first few days, establish credibility. As I always say, like as a consultant, you got to be at least 2 steps ahead of the client. What was that like?
Yeah, totally. You know, so it's always stressful because what happens is when you come in as a consultant, you're like the Mr. Know-it-all and you are a highly billable resource. You're charging almost $200+ back in, you know, it was mid 90s. So there is no honeymoon phase, unlike an employee where you get your 30-day ramp up time and get to meet people and slowly ramp up. When you're a consultant, your pressure is clicking the moment you walk into the door because you're billable. So really trying to get access to systems, understanding, you know, the different stakeholders, understanding the technology, understanding the processes, where the issues are, there's constant pressure on you. So back to the situation when I walked in and they were not able to generate invoices, there was no ramp up time. So you got to be really scrappy, understand the issues, figure out who's who, how do you access information? So which basically means the first couple of weeks you're working around the clock and trying to really work in the best interest of the client because, you know, everyone operates with what have you done for me lately, right? So you need to show demonstrable progress every day. So it's quite a lot of pressure, but it was also fun.
Yeah, I remember that from my days of being on site and consulting with clients. Like whenever you would hit the ground, there was always a group of people like, I know what he's doing. Like, you know, what's he going to do here? You know, what sort of impact is he going to make? All right, hurry up and make it. And there's definitely that pressure there every time you landed a new client.
Yeah, totally. It's always that way, right? And then there are some that don't want you to be successful too, right? Because you have multiple consultants within the same account. So again, you know, you got to have some good politically savvy skills to navigate some of that and try to be objective and bring others along.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's mariscg.com.
So it's kind of hard on the family there and moving around every 3 to 4 months. What happened after that?
Yeah, so I think my tenure in Minneapolis was high pressure. It was 4 different companies. We had a little son, and constantly being on the road and staying in hotels was quite challenging as a family. So I'm like, hey, maybe I should start to look for my next gig. And incidentally, I happened to read the CIO magazine and Cisco Systems featured in it, and more specifically, Pete Solwick, who was the CIO back then. And there was something about the whole manufacturing transformation. They had an age-old legacy system called Ming. They went from Minx and implemented Oracle. It was about a $4 billion business. So just reading that article about transformation, back in the day, nobody used that word, but really doing a mega project and cutting over systems, you know, something appealed to me that because I come from a manufacturing background that I'm like, well, I think I need to be there, right? So then I went to their website, you know, using my slow AOL browser, if you remember, through dial-up at home, right? There was no real broadband. So you're like dialed in at home, checking out their website. And I found IT engineer, system engineer job description in their manufacturing IT organization. position. So I immediately applied. Thankfully, I got called for an interview. So there were like two phone screens, and then they flew me into California. So that was my first trip to California. And for an in-person, I think there were like 7 or 8 rounds of interviews. Thankfully, I cleared all of them and I joined Cisco Systems in early 1998.
So you're in the Bay Area. The weather's a little better. You're finally firmly in the tech industry. What's your journey like at Cisco?
Yeah, so I came into Cisco, again, you know, different environment. The weather's awesome, like you said, but also there's the huge sticker price shock of costs, right? So, you know, then you soon realize, wow, you know, even finding a place to rent is quite expensive. But again, you know, the buzz of the valley, the technology, the pace, the innovation, I think is just phenomenal. So within Cisco, you know, I started off in the manufacturing organization, and the first year back to, you know, it was just like the consulting world, right? We were a fast growing company. Scaling in Asia, we had to do outsourced manufacturing in Malaysia, in Thailand, in China with Foxconn, etc. So again, how do you build and scale for a global always-on manufacturing was my first couple years of major systems and implementation and upgrade. You know, I was also fortunate in the world of mass customization that, you know, Cisco built a lot of hardware with embedded software, and our customers wanted the way they would order the equipment, the factory floor to have built it the way they have ordered it and shipped. So believe it or not, even before Amazon, you know, really came into bear, I had the opportunity to work with a startup in the Valley to build Product Configurator, which is essentially allowing your external customers to configure your chassis, your line cards, your power supply, pick the software, and then we send that to the factory. The factory builds it the way the customers expected the spec and shipped to your door, right? So all of this was e-commerce, 1.0, self-serve. We also showed you the status of your order. You could come in and expedite. If you didn't like the ship date, you could come in and request for an expedite. So we, in manufacturing, we would do everything based on, again, the customer, the need to fulfill the request, right? So you could change orders, you could expedite, you could increase quantity. So again, it was fantastic to have built the early e-commerce version of our Product Configurator.
Early into your journey at Cisco, you met a director there that was also a great mentor, Rebecca Jacoby.
Yeah, that's right, Andrew. So I joined Cisco and I got to work in my very first major program with Rebecca. She was director of manufacturing and supply chain operations. She was initially my business stakeholder. So I worked into an IT director, but then she was my business stakeholder. And that's who I worked with pretty closely in terms of defining the business strategy and how do you translate strategy into requirements and technical specs and delivery. So through the course of, you know, building that camaraderie and delivering on outcomes, we got to respect a lot and respect one another. And then subsequently, she picked up the IT organization as a part of her expanded scope and responsibility. And from running manufacturing IT, she eventually became the CIO of Cisco.
Now, while you were there, you had several different roles, starting out as a leader of IT, a director, a senior director, all the way up to a VP. How did your outlook change each step of the way?
Yeah, so again, I've been pretty thankful and humbled with the opportunities, right? So again, there's a saying that reward for good work is more work. So after having done that initial set of global manufacturing, outsourced manufacturing, building out large scale systems, that initial version of the Product Configurator, Rebecca, again, like my key mentor, basically said, you know what, I think you've led a lot of these programs as an individual contributor. And she saw in me the ability to lead teams, lead cross-functionally. And she gave me the opportunity and responsibility for a team, right? So I had a team of about 20 people to begin with as a senior manager. So again, I think it's a mix of both. How do you be a good, effective people leader? But at the same time, you got to keep, you know, being innovative and moving the organization forward with regards to business outcomes, with regards to technology, etc. So I spent my first 6.5 years in the core manufacturing area after having done a lot of transformation. Then you go, well, what's next? You want to continue to, you know, live up to your potential. So again, blessed that I got an opportunity to rotate into a go-to-market organization. So again, it's a brand new functional domain supporting sales. And when you walk in, you get humbled, right? Which means that you've joined a team now that you're not the expert anymore. And in manufacturing, your phone buzzed 24/7. You were the go-to person, everybody looked up to you, and now suddenly you have a director title, you join a new team, you don't have the stakeholder relationships, you don't have the credibility, you don't have the business knowledge, you don't have the systems knowledge. So you're basically starting from scratch. And it's humbling in a way where how do you, from that vulnerable situation, go about learning, iterating, delivering on your commitments, leading your team, building credibility within your team, your peers, your business stakeholders, and then delivering the outcomes, right? So again, I think that journey, having rotated into a new team and hitting the ground running again, back to my consulting experience, you know, learning a lot of those attributes of building and forging great relationships and partnerships, and at the same time, driving the technology agenda and transformation was quite an undertaking. And we had a lot of successes in scaling our go-to-market platforms. Back in the day, Cisco was one of the largest customers of Salesforce. They were the first software as a service CRM capability. And we started off deploying that in the commercial segment. And it was a foreign term. What is software as a service and how do you integrate? And both Salesforce and Cisco IT learned a lot via the transformation and via the journey. It was over a three-year journey before we retired our legacy Siebel platform and went all in with Salesforce for our sales CRM, coupled with many other capabilities that other platform providers like Oracle and SAP made up the overall tech stack, along with a lot of homegrown software development that we had to build, given that we are a fairly complex business selling both direct and indirect across 60,000 channel partners, etc.
As your influence grew and you became promoted to like a director level, now you're not just hiring for the stuff you have to do today, you have to kind of hire a bench for the stuff you're going to do tomorrow as well. How did you make that happen?
Yeah. So again, a lot of learning through that process, right? Because over time, you build a team that you're fairly familiar with. And there were some people that I cherry picked from my manufacturing IT role, people that I had that working relationship with, etc. But then when you get to the next level and you're thinking about transformation, you need to be applying, you know, am I solving problems for today versus anticipate what the potential future problems are, right? And how do you prepare the organization? You know, applying the 10-10-3 philosophy of at least 10% of your top talent working at least 10% of their time for problems that are 3 years out. So when you look at that approach and that principle and look at your team and go through the skills assessment and capability and competency, you realize that you want to have a diverse team, right? Diverse not just from a gender and ethnicity, but also diversity in terms of experience, skill set, etc. Again, doing an organization pyramid analysis to say, are you too top heavy? Do you have a good mix of fresh university hires early in career? Do you have seasoned people? And then whatever gaps are, how do you make that a case to infuse new talent, right? And sometimes you have to infuse new talent from other industries, from other verticals, etc. The concept of talent planning and organizational capability assessment is something that you start to pick up as you go more senior. And at that time, you know, you also need to, as a leader, be objective, right? And have the open conversation with people that are brilliant for today's problem versus lacking what the future needs are. And either you can coach them and develop them, or you know, you also need to have, at some point, somebody's not going to have the skills, right? And you bucketize in terms of education, experience, and exposure. So if there's a new technology, there's a new set of skills, you can drive the education, right? But at the same time, you also need to give them the right exposure and put them on things that are meaningful. So that way you allow them to learn and iterate. I hate to use the word fail, but at the same time, in a way, there's that learning and failing aspect of it that you have to do in a continuum. So again, long story short, I think every leader needs to think about their organization pyramid. Do you have a good mix? Do you truly have a global diverse team? You know, and are you thinking at least 10-10-3 principle? Our business models were shifting. So again, you needed people that could operate for today, but you also needed people that could get you ready for the tomorrow.
Syrinx has spent a lot of time and effort over the past 25 years building our reputation for quality and our brand. There was one big problem, though. No one could pronounce our name correctly.
Person on the street, brand testing, take one. Hi, can you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
That's a really good guess.
Really?
Now, how would you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
Not even close. Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Shrinks.
Luckily for us, Syrinx was acquired in 2022 by the DeWinter Group. We're rebranding Syrinx under DeWinter's highly regarded technology consulting arm, Meris Consulting Group. We bring Syrinx's deep technology delivery experience, and they bring broader delivery capabilities and a new identity as Meris.
Here's what you can count on from the unified Meris. We are now a nationwide powerhouse when it comes to technology consulting, from DevOps to developers, to project managers, to business systems.
So join me in welcoming our future as Meris. Hopefully people will have an easier time pronouncing this one.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maris.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maurice.
Is that your uncle's name? Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Mars.
That's a planet.
Maybe not.
So contact Meris today, and we'll help you get your project done on time and on budget. You can call us at 408-297-7500, or you can find us on the web at mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com.
Now, when you scale up to enough folks, like, you can no longer be in every meeting, know every detail. So how do you kind of use like a metrics and outcomes system to manage things when it gets that big?
Yeah, and that was a big transition, right? It's never easy for someone like me who loved the details. It's very difficult to suddenly let go, right? And letting go, I think, is a key skill set that you have to learn. You know, one of my former mentors, Andy Starr, you know, unfortunately, he's no more. He always said, knowing the details versus managing the details. So again, having grown and risen through the ranks, I know a lot of the details, but at the same time, do you manage it for your team versus poke and ask the right sets of questions and test the overall comprehensive thinking and the approach that your team's going to take? Slowly distancing yourself from the day-to-day and having the right measurement and management practices and techniques, where as a leader, we started to embrace things like objectives and key results. So you are defining the vision, you're defining the strategies, and you're defining the objectives. And then working with my own leadership team, capturing what the key results are, and then having this framework. So then your management technique is you're reviewing on a regular basis, week after week. Are you moving the needle in the right direction? And then as a leader, you also sometimes need to see around the bends and the edges. Are you able to ask the right sets of questions, coach your team, give them enough chances, but at the same time, know when to intervene and when to step in. And then lastly, to have the right governance in place where you're bringing your key stakeholders regularly, because one of the biggest things in IT, people use the word is lack of transparency. No matter how hard you try, people will always say IT costs too much, takes too long, and we're not too sure what we're getting from IT. So that's a typical industry message you tend to hear. And therefore, as an IT leader, you're always thinking about what does the transparency mean? How are we showing up? Are we showing up as equal business partners? Are we speaking the language of the business? Are we able to demonstrate through metrics and objectives and key results the progress that are being made or lack thereof? And if there are issues and challenges, how do you put the elephant on the table and not be afraid to have that hard conversation? Because one of the things in IT, and Rebecca Jacoby, my mentor, you know, did a big change in the whole client-funded model where the business was funding IT. So therefore, by definition, you become a subserving to the business rather than what does true equal business partnership mean? Because at the end of the day, we all work for the same company. The difference is we are enabling the business. And we got to be cost conscious. We got to be efficiency conscious. And it's a two-sided coin. The business on one side of the coin owns the investment, while on the other side of the coin, it's the way we get work done. So again, you got to balance the investment and the expense. And are you trying to drive the right outcomes? And that to me is a 50-50 partnership with the business. You know, as I started to transition and grow up the ranks, it is more about having the courageous conversation, pushing back on the business where things didn't make sense. When you see gaps across the functions because you're working with different general managers, different product lines, are you having the right conversation to drive alignment and maximizing the value for money? Because at the end of the day, it's the company's money.
Yeah, in the pre-call, you mentioned something interesting that they would look at, okay, for every incremental additional $1 million in revenue, how much more do we have to spend on IT to get there? And you're kind of trying to make it as efficient as possible. What did you do there?
Yeah, absolutely. Having the right measurements, right? So one is you're measuring productivity, you're measuring cycle time, you're measuring quality, you're measuring risk, etc. But one of the other key measures is as the business is growing their top line. So let's say for every incremental top line revenue growth of $1 million, what is the IT cost to serve? And if you plot that for every incremental 1 million revenue, if your expense is also increasing in proportion to that 1 million in revenue, then you're not doing a good job. So therefore, the metric is for every incremental $1 million revenue brought in, can you demonstrate via more automation, via better efficiency, different ways of doing things to show that your cost curve is going in the different direction rather than your revenue curve. So that is what Nirvana would look like, and the ability for us to constantly look at it in your different processes, whether it's your quote to cash process, and look for inefficiencies. What causes quotes to get manually touched by your back office functions? Why do approvals have to go through X number of people? How do you build approvals that are business rules driven, and only when something is a complex deal where the T's and C's are different, the legal contract requires something different, you're trying to discount, you know, much more than your standard practices, then you put the right revenue and rigors and controls, right? But a lot of the businesses, you know, doesn't have to necessarily go through that many. I'm just using that as an example. So again, constantly looking at, you know, seller productivity, back office productivity, how much automation can you drive? Can IT build capabilities where they don't have to be in the middle of launching a new product, launching of a new price book, driving renewal increase of X percent year after year? All of this, you know, IT should just digitize and not be in the way and let the business do everything self-serve.
Are there any folks from Cisco you'd like to give a shout out to?
Oh, there are so many. You know, I think I spent almost 22 years, you know, I learned a lot and I learned a lot from many people. So again, you know, I might miss a few, but I think the biggest ones in IT being Rebecca, she was a, you know, huge mentor. Guillermo Diaz was a subsequent CIO. Irving Tan, who was the chief operating officer. Many of my peers that have been there. And then in the business unit side, I learned a lot from working with the likes of Scott Harrell, Todd Nightingale, Chris Story, Anand Oswal. Again, this is a short list, Anna Corrales, etc. So again, I think having grown through the ranks and built real lifelong relationships, you know, you cherish that. And then also like to thank my own team, right? Because a lot of the success as a leader is also what your team does. So again, I'm always humbled by the sacrifices and the hard work and the commitment that my own team put in.
So like a lot of places, things get a little topsy-turvy during the pandemic and you get a call out of the blue for an opportunity to be a CIO yourself.
Yeah, that's right. So again, you know, in Cisco, it's a large organization and I was the CIO for the software business unit. So again, as a part of my career aspirations, it's like, hey, how do you drive your career path from a CIO perspective and scope and responsibility? In 2021, thought after that many years at Cisco, what's my next transition like? And I joined Anaplan, right? There were two known leaders in Anaplan, the CEO, Frank Calderoni, and the chief product officer, Anna Pinczuk. So I reported into Anna Pinczuk and I got the opportunity to be the CIO at Anaplan.
And while you're there, you're kind of like a change agent for their internal technology. What are you doing there?
Yeah, so I spent about a year and a half at Anaplan. And coming in again, right, it's a new company. You have to understand it's a software as a service business model. They are leaders in the XPNA, which is anything planning and analysis and forecasting technology, really loved by a lot of the financial and sales community and leaders. And then they were making major inroads into supply chain as well. So coming in, two aspects of the role. One is as a customer and as a practitioner, can you be credible with your peers in the industry, showcasing as a practitioner your own use of the product, use cases, lessons learned, scars, and instilling that and sharing those examples and best practices with your peers? So that was a big chunk of the job. But occasionally, you know, you're also tapped in from a network perspective to help the sales organization make the right connections and contacts. So though I didn't really generate any revenue and opportunities, I was heavily influencing a lot of the opportunities. Then the second part of it is, you know, how do you run the IT organization? How do you build capabilities for the go-to-market, for the finance, and then for all your internal employees, and security is front and center as well.
Didn't you build like a peer industry group while you were there?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, you know, building a pure CIO network of all the practitioners, and obviously during the pandemic, the opportunity to come together face to face was fairly limited. So a lot of these were virtual sessions where you host a roundtable of my peer CIOs, peer CTOs, and really not talk so much about the product, but also talk about general industry trends, what's top of mind for everyone in the industry, lessons learned, any trends they're seeing. And then also some of them was open discussions in terms of, you know, hey, here's the challenge I'm facing internally with stakeholder XYZ. Are there tips and tricks that, you know, one can share? So I think it ranged from technology to trends to leadership lessons and leadership 101, and also unlocking any network opportunities where, Andrew, you might know person XYZ and I'm trying to make that connection. And just because of our credibility and relationship, can you help me unlock that relationship too?
At the end of the day, like, that always comes second to making sure that, you know, the lights are on and everything's churning. You have to be an operator first. What did you learn as far as that aspect of the job?
First, you've got to be an operator. And operator meaning it's kind of like, you know, if you're using the phone, you know, obviously many of us are using the mobile phone, but for those that still have the dial tone, is the dial tone on? Or if you're thinking of gas and electricity and water, is it always on? You expect it to be always on, right? So in the same vein within IT, as an operator, you expect your services to be on. Are all my systems up and running? A new employee joins, can you ensure that they have their laptop on day one or day zero? And it's all configured, it's ready to go, especially in the modern environment, right? To me, always on services, when you do a good job on those where your systems are up, you're able to book orders, you're able to close the financial books, you're able to measure the business performance with metrics, your ARR, your net new ARR, are you paying your sellers, are you paying your employees? So again, all of those are fundamentals. And if you're doing them well and with high quality and high SLAs, then you get the keys to have a transformation agenda conversation with the C-suite. So then you go, well, I now will move beyond my operator hat to being a transformation and a change agent. And the change agency really is about, again, in companies that I've seen where the marketing team, the go-to-market team, the finance team, they all work in silos. And one of the beautiful things of being in IT is you get the full view of the business. You're looking at things across the board and without any emotion coming back and saying, look, stakeholder X, you're asking me to do this, and stakeholder Y, you're asking me to do this, and you two are not aligned, and I can be the change agent to bring you both in the same meeting and raise conflicts, raise issues, potential gaps, etc. And then truly drive a portfolio conversation. Because at the end of the day, my strong belief is it's the company's money, it's not departmental budget. So again, how do you maximize the value for money and really build a portfolio and a roadmap where you have a horizon one, horizon two, and horizon three, right? Because you want to keep pushing on a three-year roadmap, but you're able to deliver and execute in chunks. So again, for me, the big part of my job was holding the chief people officer, the chief financial officer, the chief revenue officer, the chief product officer, bringing them regularly, walking them through the operations agenda, the IT agenda, and building a plan that we all can stand behind, right, with the clearly defined business outcomes and with clearly defined investment profile, and then updating the board on a regular basis. I think that was a big undertaking.
Towards the latter half of last year, you got an opportunity to join PagerDuty as their first CIO. First off, for folks that don't know, like, what is PagerDuty? What do they do?
Yeah, good question, Andrew. So PagerDuty, we are a digital operations management platform. So we serve a lot of the DevOps community. We started off serving a lot of the DevOps. So think of us like, how do we ensure our customers have services always on, up and running? And with software, if there's an issue, if there's an outage, how do we quickly get the right people on a call and resolve the incident as quickly as possible? So in other words, our goal is to minimize any customer disruption. So if you're on a website making a buying or a purchasing decision, and if there's an issue, how quickly can we ensure that there's no loss in revenue and the website is up and running and you as a consumer can buy, right? So again, our job is to enable our customers to be always up, always on, and therefore we are a digital operations management platform that serves multiple stakeholders, but the main ones being our DevOps engineers.
Now, you said that at a SaaS company, CIO often means chief integration officer. How does that manifest itself?
It's funny because I think everyone says chief information officer. But again, as a SaaS company, you know, and talking to my peers as well, pretty much a lot of the SaaS companies have a lot of technology, right? Because I think one thing of SaaS is it's a blessing and a curse, is where it's easy to plug in and deploy. And then slowly you realize that you have five work management tools. You've got five collaboration technology tools. You know, you can have many security tools, et cetera. So when I did an inventory of all the SaaS assets that we had, and we call it the SaaS sprawl, it's very difficult to say who's using what, how often are they using, what value are they getting, and what do we do with the technology and how do we rationalize it? So again, the reason I said as a chief integration officer is because you have all these disparate technology. But at the end of the day, you have to pivot it with, in PagerDuty, we refer to our employees as Dutonians, right? What's the Dutonian experience, right? From when we are trying to source candidates and interview candidates to onboarding them and then driving their engagement within the company, to our customer experience, all the way from early prospecting and early awareness to potentially making a buying decision. And then what's their post-sale experience and their customer satisfaction. And then likewise, your partners, right? So when you think about your employee experience, your partner experience, your customer experience, that's what the CIOs need to think about. And therefore, you know, you're not talking technology X and technology Y and technology Z. We have to seamlessly integrate them in a way that we are driving efficiency, we are driving the process transformation, we're also thinking of it from a data perspective, right? And threading the data so that we can get the full view of the business. So that's why I jokingly always say it's a chief integration officer.
Now, you know, as you mentioned before, the Bay Area, very expensive to live in, hard to build a team 100% located there. How have you utilized folks from other locales in order to support your efforts there at PagerDuty?
So I think a lot of the initial companies, right, when you start and you go IPO and you build a team, you build capabilities, a lot of them are nearshore, right? So in our case, in Anaplan and in PagerDuty, we have a lot of employees and talent in high-cost locations. And obviously, every company needs to be a profitable company, right? And every SaaS company is being held to a rule of 40, right? Which is, how are you driving your top line? And also, how are you managing your bottom line? And your top line growth plus, you know, your operating margin is the rule of 40. So with that treasure, you know, you have to be looking at your talent, you have to look at your skill mix and say what kinds of skills and resources you need in what kinds of locations. And also, we aspire to be a global company, right? Most of our business, if you split between, obviously today, a lion's share is in North America, but then you have EMER, Europe, Middle East, and Asia, and APJ, which is also including Australia, New Zealand, Japan. When you think of all these theaters and growth projections, you're going to add resources across the globe. So therefore, as an IT practitioner, back to being an operator, right, you need presence, not in every location, but in the geographical locations that you can provide your always-on services. And at the same time, you need IT folks to be closer to your stakeholders. You know, I'm a big proponent of a day in the life of, right? What's a day in the life of a seller in Australia, right? And what's a day in the life of an account exec selling in a large enterprise account versus a commercial account versus a small, medium business account, right? So again, I think having that ears and eyes and feet on the ground to understand the true practitioner's pain point and opportunity will help you design better systems and better capabilities, right? So therefore, to me, I think we are trying to look at, again, you know, how do we use India? How do we use Lisbon? How do we use Argentina? How do we use, you know, Chile? Again, you can't be in every location, but at least some key prime locations where you have a good mix of talent, access to talent, and at the same time, you know, your org pyramid of, you know, early in career, university hiring, experienced professionals. And I also have some capabilities that may be future looking, right? And how do you infuse new talent as well within the organization? So again, my general approach is skill based, look at where your business is growing, and you need a mix of operators, and you also need a mix of people that can think of problems 3 years out.
And you mentioned an interesting perspective on kind of how big companies and small companies handle charity. What's your take there?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's all access to resources and funding, right? So I think as a part of Cisco, we had many charitable organizations that regularly, as you know, you could consciously make an effort with regards to having team building. We did a lot of team building activities, Habitat for Humanity or Second Food Harvest, drives like that. We also did a lot around the March of Dimes, et cetera. So again, I think it's access to resources and then being as a leader conscious and working with your organization to carve out X amount of time every quarter to make this a priority. In smaller companies, you know, there are programs, but obviously access to resources, and especially now in this pandemic world, you know, how do you really bring people together, I think is a challenge. But we are trying to be, you know, creative and use online means of still ensuring that as an organization, you are thinking of the community, you're socially aware, you're thinking about the different charitable events and trying to do the best. So again, I think it's right now it's the macro, it's the pandemic. If I had the opportunity to bring a group of people together, it also helps from a team building perspective, right? And for and supporting a noble cause. So again, now we are trying to be more innovative, being virtual rather than, you know, together.
So Sesh, thank you so much for joining us on Underserved and sharing with our listeners your stories and experiences.
Thank you, Andrew. I really enjoyed our conversation.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.